been 35 years since the publication of In Praise of Creoleness, the manifesto by Jean Bernabé, Patrick Chamisseau, and Raphael Confiant. And I think in some ways, despite the fact that it's been criticized by many writers and thinkers in the Caribbean tradition, I do think it continues to have immense relevance. And its relevance in some ways is despite all of its criticisms. I think criticisms of it for being too ontological, being too fixated on identity and so forth, actually end up in many ways being strengths of the manifesto that other works that often are deployed as a critique of the manifesto. I think the manifesto does work that those works themselves need to do. Now, what I mean by that is, first, the criticism that the manifesto offers Creoleness as an ontology, as a theory of being, specifically the being of Antillean subjects, is too fixed and calcified. I think in some ways that's a fair criticism. I think that they do make a series of declarations that both indicate and reproduce the notion that Creoleness is a fixed identity. I think one of the things that often gets overlooked in that criticism, and I don't think that this is simply an aside remark for me, but really a criticism of criticisms, is that people who levy that kind of critique don't appreciate, right, or don't take seriously the genre of the manifesto, that the genre of the manifesto is such that it has a hyperbole of declaration that then lends itself to further analysis and more subtle parsing of phrases, subtle parsing of methods and framings. And for me, that's what's productive about manifestos, is that they not only reflect a series of conclusions and declarations generated from, we always have to presume, years and years of thinking and conversation, but also that those manifestos make thinking possible, that they distill it into the manifesto through declarations, their own thinking, but they also give to us something to think about, something to think through, and something to think and treat in a systematic and hopefully complicated way. Now, for me, that really comes around the very, you know, the significance of that invitation to thinking circles around exactly the terms of criticism. For me, I don't think that the idea that it's offering or trying to offer an ontology of the Creole subject is a negative. I think that that criticism is used in some ways to provoke Glissant scholars to say, you know, well, Creolization is about motion and movement and chaos, and Creolité or Creoleness is about a fixed identity and sort of deploying the father against the son, so to speak, right? Just to use their own characterizations and vocabulary. But I think that it itself is not a problem to calcify and to declare a sense of identity. I think without those declarations of identity, you end up with traditions that continue to operate without clear lines of debate. So in this way, for me, I think what I like about the manifesto's description of the Creole subject is not so much, you know, whether it's true or not, but instead what the declaration of the Creole subject does to get us to think in a tradition. That traditions are not generated by shared ideas or shared formulations, but instead by deep agonistic relationships. And one of the things that always strikes me about this movement post-Fanon, most of the texts that we've read across this semester, that those texts from Walcott, from Brathwaite, from Glissant, I think in some ways you can say also about Naipaul, but that's a little bit more complicated, And certainly about Wilson Harris, and maybe also about Maurice Conde, which is the main focus of the next conversation. But that all of those operate in the same space of a subjectivity in motion, a subjectivity dedicated to pure becoming. One of the difficulties for me in theorizing subjectivity as pure becoming, like somebody like Glissant does, or somebody like Wilson Harris does with this notion of creelness, what Walcott has in mind when he's thinking about fragments of memory, Brathwaite's notion of nation language, that in all of these, you know, there's no real footing for critique. There's no footing for critique because it never is a strong declarative moment. Now, the lack of a strong declarative moment is, I think, actually part of the content of that thought, that thinking from fragments, thinking about subjectivity as being in motion, and therefore cultural and literary production coming out of that, bearing that, reflecting that, drawing from that, that, you know, when that is our model, you know, a lot of characterizations of culture and a lot of interpretations of cultural production and a lot of guides, I don't want to say prescriptions, that's too strong, but sort of guidebooks for writing in that tradition emerge. But how does one actually get footing to critique something like that? Well, for me, that's where the Caribbean tradition, if we're thinking about it as this broader historical phenomenon, it needed the manifesto. And what it needed the manifesto for is that traditions really operate and draw their vitality from these moments of declaration and deep critique. I think about History of the Voice, where Brathwaite evokes Glissant, and he's evokes Glissant in such this positive way. You know, there's no sense in which Brathwaite is generating his own position in an agonistic or conflictual relationship with Glissant, or really with anybody. And that's fine. I mean, that's just a different model of working theory. But I think that working theory in an agonistic way helps us really get a strong handle on what we mean by tradition and how traditions move. So in the interview that you know is worth discussing in the next piece, Creolite Bites, where Chamusseau and Confiant and a little bit Bernabé talk about the manifesto and its reception, one of the things that will interest me about that, and I'll save this for another conversation, but one of the things that interests me is how that agonism and that conflict that they talk about with the Africans, with other Antillians, a sort of tense relationship with African-American questions of things like Ebonics and institutionalization of language, that these are all ways that the manifesto declared some grounds that then become sites for such intense debate. And that such intense debate, staging of it, actually has made clearer everything that came before it and so much that came after it. So when, in some ways, when the opening line says, "We are not this list of things, we are Creoles," what they do is distill the essential insights of Wilson Harris, of Derek Walcott, of Camo Brathwaite, Edouard Glissant, and as we'll see also in some ways, Maurice Conde, that to be Creole is to be Creole, to be mixed of all of these crossroads that comprise the Caribbean as history, as linguistic formation, as cultural influences, and as the movement of memory. Right, all of these things happen in a chaotic fashion, and therefore, in some ways, by saying we are Creoles, they just give a final formulation to what so many of these other thinkers were fumbling toward. They were fumbling toward it, almost saying it, and the Creolists come along and really make that declaration. And when they make that declaration, all of a sudden, we have to respond to it. Have they calcified this? Have they distilled it too intensely? What do they miss? What is the notion of time? What is the notion of dynamism? What is the notion of chaos inside this calcified identity? All these critical questions all of a sudden have a real point. And by point, I mean like a point of like a spear or a knife, right? That it's able to cut to the heart of the question of what it means to be and to know in a creolizing context. All of those things for me become so much clearer after the manifesto. Now, at the same time, I think one of the really difficult conversations that they try to open up is this question of Caribbean literature. Now, Caribbean literature, you know, does it exist? What does it mean for it to exist? What does it mean to be an author, a novelist who writes the Caribbean novel, is a tortured question since World War II. We didn't read George Lamming in this class, but Lamming is worth evoking here. Then some of his nonfiction from the 1950s and 1960s into the 70s, Lamming was really exploring this notion that that he was writing novels for an audience that did not exist, right? And so for Lamming, it was this question of do we have a national literature? Do we have a Caribbean literature or Antillean literature? Was for him about the freedom of the author, but also the essential and unbreakable connection between author and audience. What makes that such a difficult relationship between author and audience is that the audience for Caribbean literature did not exist at the time that Lamming is writing. So for him, he's writing to an absent audience, to an audience to come. I find that completely fascinating as an idea. I think that's super interesting. But what the Creolists show in the manifesto, or at least assert and challenge us to think about, is how that national literature, or regional or hemispheric, however you want to put it, literature, Caribbean or Antillean literature, is not a question of simply the relationship of the author to reader. That in some ways is too politically neutral in terms of the politics of culture. And what they instead want to argue is that there's that the question of a Caribbean literature to come, a Caribbean literature in the future, is the question of a literature written from the people. Rather than to an audience, it's written from the people. They would never get into, you know, questions of Marx or Marxism or Maoism or any of these, radical political movements in the 60s and 70s that were as cultural as they were, about statecraft or revolutionary insurrection. But they have something very much in common with that left-wing politics of their own youth, right, of their own young adulthood, which is that a really legitimate revolution comes from the people. And that in this case, the writer and the audience have to be connected through this third term or this umbrella term or this term that connects the difference between the writer and the author, which is the people. Because the people is neither me, the author, nor you, the reader. The people is that ontogenesis, that genesis of our very being, that exceeds us, yet makes us possible. And possible in very specific ways. The specific way of ontogenesis, right, the specific way that the people make the author and reader for the Creolists is in vernacular language. That's why Creole language is so important to them. So it's not simply, it's not simply that the question of Creole language is important because Just a question of, you know, this is a preferred expressive medium, or this is the expressive medium sort of most intimate to this particular place, or it's my home language and let's try experimental writing from that. Rather, the connection between author and the author's, I would say, ethical commandments, ethical dictates as a writer, derive from that embeddedness in the people, so that to write to a Caribbean audience is to write to the people and to write as the people. So language, again, you know, I know I'm repeating myself here, but it's so important. Like language as a manifestation of ontogenesis, of the genesis of personhood, right, of both a reader, an author, and the people, right, as the generator of those, is so deeply connected to language. And it's not for them, and if you read something, you know, a text like Texico or Solibola Magnificent or School Days or Mademoiselle Butterfly, you know, all of these various texts by Confiant and Chamasseau, what you learn is not that it's some sort of performance of Creole as like the language. Rather, it's this connection to the specificity of a people in this place, and that it's this kind of mixture, this kind of playfulness between Creole and French, you know, especially for Chamasseau, the playfulness of the relationship between Creole and French that adds this dynamic dimension to the literature. And it's a dynamic dimension to the literature that for him, and this is so important, is not his sort of genius as a writer or his creativity as a writer, but rather his attempt to tell the story of what it means to be Antillean. And what it means to be Antillean is inseparable from language, right? And how do you actually make that sense of language, literature, and the language, literature, and the relationship between the writer and the people? How do you make that work? Well, the way you make that work is for me to, or for the manifesto, is to make sure that there's no abstraction moment, there's no generalization moment in that configuration of a relationship between author and reader, but rather that embeddedness between people, right? And what that does, and this is a criticism, another criticism that's been levied against the Creolists, and in some ways we'll see Maurice Condé repeats this, is that that limits your audience, right? That you end up writing a literature about this particular place, this small place. But one of the things I really love about the manifesto, and it's always my defense of it, right, insofar as it needs to be defended, it doesn't really need to be defended, but one of my defenses of it is like, look, all literatures are literatures of small place. The difference is that the small place literature of the Creolists get named and really emphatically sort of tuned to this notion of a small place because they've never had an imperial moment. Whereas French, of course, has its imperial moment, that centuries of colonialism and enslavement. So then it becomes a global language, but it's really a language from a small place. Right, and what it means to identify that as a small place, I think, is important. It's that moment where it's like, you know, somebody like Flaubert, who's such an important, you know, world historical figure in literature, is writing about a very specific place in a very specific way with a very specific language. Now, how you think out of that, how you get out of that constriction, right, is through this imperial notion of language and through this idea of it being in some ways untranslatable or not in need of translation. And that Creole then becomes, or Creolized literature of small places becomes something that has to be translated, whereas the universal concerns of a Flaubert or somebody else, right, this is a French, Hugo or any of these French literary figures, they don't have to answer to how do you translate your small place into a universal claim or to a broader readership. They don't have to do that because their literature is so embedded in the imperial question of language, right? And in that way, I think about, you know, syllabic intelligence from History of the Voice. I love that phrase, where also elsewhere, Brathwaite will call it syntactical intelligence, right? The arrangement of words and the sound of words and the way the words carry a rhythm with them. That's so connected to place. And it's like, how do you actually articulate author-reader in literature as national literature, literature as cultural production, innovation, revolution, right? In a way of, as they say in the manifesto, of having a positive interior vision of the self. How do you do all of that? Well, the way you do all of that is through, again, connecting the question of author and reader to an ontogenesis that is connected to language and place. Affirm this notion of the small place and see what happens with the literature after that. So the aspirations of the Creolists are in some ways island aspiration. They're not global aspiration. When we read Condé, that's part of her hesitation, and I think it's an important hesitation, but it's also one that they have a response to already in the manifesto. And that response is, we have to understand our interior life and see it in literature. And interior life has a language, right? When we don't, you know, there is no monologue, right, without language, right? Every monologue is a dialogue inside our own heads. It's a way we speak to ourselves, right? So to a speaker and spoken to in a language, that thought is taking place in that language. So if we're going to have an interior vision of self, right, that affirms that self rather than tries to modify and change it for colonial and imperial reasons, then we need the language and sense of place that that interior life is made of in order to affirm it. And so I think there's a kind of cultural and political therapy in this notion of Creoleness and literary production that is so deeply important and easily forgotten and overlooked and downplayed. That I can't emphasize that enough, because when the criticisms come in, like this is too calcified in terms of a subject and subjectivity, I understand it at a certain kind of theoretical level, but it's maybe an excess or a kind of flirtation with an epistemological sin that is in the service of authorizing Creole culture and Creole notions of self as worthy of literary production and literary language. Once we can get there, we really get ourselves in a position to understand what Antillean life is. And then we can ask the questions of translation and how does this become a part of a larger global audience? How does this, the readership go beyond, you know, Fort de France or, you know, Pointe-à-Pitre in Guadeloupe? And how do we think about these places and their languages and their vernaculars without always immediately going to the global and to the translation and to the translatable? You know, for me, this is in like always of such deep value. And everybody, I mean, empires hold on to their languages and their literatures and their articulations of self because they know it's important to sustaining what it means to be French. So in that way, for me, despite it being anti-nationalist in so many important ways, and there's that little like 2.5 pages at the end of a kind of sketch of a politics of Creolité, right? It's very anti-nationalist in that way. But its nationalism for me is the most productive way I could think of a nationalism, which is for the subaltern, for the marginalized, to the voiceless, to find that sense of voice, not through the genius and flash of insight of the great author, but instead the author as the one who harnesses the creativity of the people, produces it, makes it reflect, lets it reflect in a literary work, so that then the reader is immersed in the exact same world, the same world that is familiar to them when they are from that small place, but also for others to understand that this is a world with words for everything, with ideas for everything, with a sense of self, with a sense of collectivity, and a sense of what it would mean to be, in this case, Antillean, and to be Antillean in the deepest and most expansive sense, which is to be Creole.